Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. So to reduce costs, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. Over 70,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/GPS. netsuite.com/GPS.
This is GPS, the Global Public Square. Welcome to all of you in the United States and around the world. I'm Fareed Zakaria, coming to you live from New York. Today on the program, the United States versus Iran. American soldiers killed in Jordan. U.S. ships attacked in the Red Sea. Missiles and drones launched at American bases. And Iran's proxies claim responsibility for it all. America has begun to respond. Is it the right way? How can an all-out war be avoided? I'll ask an expert panel. Then, American aid to Ukraine and Israel is being held up until the troubles at America's border with Mexico are fixed. David Frum will explain why he calls this the GOP's great betrayal. Also, we'll tell you all about the most interesting world leader to break onto the scene in quite a while. Argentina's Javier Milei. But first, here's my take. It's perhaps fitting that the line that best describes U.S. foreign policy toward the Middle East over the last 15 years comes from The Godfather. In the third movie, the aging Michael Corleone has been trying to distance himself from his old mafia businesses and ties. But inevitably, crises flare up that demand his attention. He cries,
"Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in."
President Biden might be thinking just that as he responded militarily to the recent attack on U.S. forces that claimed the lives of three American soldiers in Jordan. Ever since George W. Bush's second term, American administrations have been seeking to reduce their exposure to the Middle East. The argument makes logical sense. The U.S. imports only a tiny amount of oil from the region. Its efforts at regime change and reform in Iraq backfired spectacularly. The most important challenges to the American-led international order come from Russia in Europe and China in Asia. The Middle East is a sideshow. But crises come not at times and places of your choosing. And the withdrawal of American power has itself set in play a series of moves that are now shaping the region. As Washington has lost interest in the Middle East, anti-American militias have been gaining strength and influence, from the Houthis to Hezbollah to Islamic Resistance in Iraq, an umbrella group that is believed to be responsible for the attack that killed the American soldiers in Jordan. Iran is allied to all these groups, which helps it preserve its influence and weight in the region. Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza has provided an ideal opportunity for these forces because they can claim to be protesting Israel's actions and thus assert themselves, demonstrate their might, and gain legitimacy. Ironically, the Biden administration, which has been working hard to prevent these militia attacks from turning into something bigger, now needs to decide whether its own retaliation might cause an escalation of hostilities. Biden is under pressure at home from Republicans who will accuse him of looking weak. Senators like Lindsey Graham have been urging him to hit Iran to preserve America's credibility. The Biden response seems to have been careful and measured. A larger attack would be a mistake. These militias thrive on conflict with established armies. The Houthis endured nearly a decade of massive Saudi bombardment and came out largely unscathed. As Henry Kissinger noted in a foreign affairs essay on Vietnam, mere weeks before becoming Nixon's national security advisor, There is a simple rule. The guerrilla wins if he does not lose. The conventional army loses if it does not win. The tragedy of American foreign policy is that having seen the dilemma so clearly, once Kissinger entered government, he got seduced by the need to preserve the U.S.'s credibility and pressured not to look weak. So he supported massive military action against the North Vietnamese forces, which failed. The North won in Vietnam by not losing, and America lost by not winning. Iran's proxies are trying to stir up as much chaos as possible to force the U.S. and Israel into large-scale strategic blunders, not to mention to spoil a possible normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The attacks by Islamic resistance in Iraq on U.S. forces have a specific goal: pressure the government of Iraq to expel U.S. forces stationed in that country. The group's militias are the very ones that support the current Shia-dominated government in Baghdad. In a battle between Washington and these militias, the Baghdad government would have to side with those groups that sustain it in power. That would then complete the takeover of Iraq by Iran, symbolized by the expulsion of American troops. And it would further the larger Iranian goal of unraveling the U.S.-built security system in the Persian Gulf. The Biden administration had to respond to these attacks on U.S. troops, but it chose a limited response and should take care not to get into a tit-for-tat with the militias. The Iranians have signaled in several different ways that they are not looking to escalate either. The most effective response to this broader Iran-backed push against American interests in the region would be to show not that Washington can escalate militarily, which of course it can do, but that it can de-escalate politically, meaning that it can use the crisis in Gaza to create conditions for longer-term stability. And that means working to create conditions for Israeli security and Palestinian aspirations for a state, which would then make it much easier not just for Saudi, but broader Arab-Israeli reconciliation. That kind of political and diplomatic response would not appease the war hawks in Washington, but it would be the most effective counter to America's foes. As Michael Corleone says in the same movie, never hate your enemies. It affects your judgment. Go to CNN.com/Fareed for a link to my Washington Post column this week. And let's get started. Last Sunday, three U.S. soldiers were killed in Jordan by Iraqi militias backed by Iran. On Friday, the U.S. responded with strikes on military sites in Iraq and Syria used by Iran and its proxies. Over the weekend, the U.S. and U.K. struck another Iran-backed group, the Houthis of Yemen, who have been harassing international ships in the Red Sea. Is the Middle East spiraling into a broader war? Vali Nasser was recently in the region. He is a professor at Johns Hopkins. Mina Al-Oraibi is the editor-in-chief of The National, a state-backed newspaper in Abu Dhabi. Vali, let me start with you with the kind of urgent question of the moment, which is, you've seen these attacks that the United States has done in response to the militia attacks from the Houthis and the others. Do you think that these militias are going to escalate, or do you think they viewed this as a fairly limited, calculated response by the United States?
I think the killing of the three Americans brought a sort of a moment of truth for Tehran, Hezbollah, and the Houthis all together to see whether or not they want to go any further than they have. And I think they do not want to escalate into a full-fledged confrontation with the United States. They expected the United States to hit back. I think they're happy that the United States has not hit Iran, that it has hit specific targets that it has associated with particular actions of these militias. And I think the Iranians have at least put out in their own newspapers and media that no Iranians were killed, no Iranians were there, the buildings were empty, which means that they're not claiming any casualties that requires escalation. So I would anticipate that the Houthis and the Iraqi militias will have to show some kind of a reaction, but it would not be at a level that would escalate this conflict. And that depends on what the United States does next.
And Vali, just give us a sense, again, one of the questions, the burning questions is, how independently do these militias act? Is it likely that Iran planned and pulled the trigger on this, on these attacks that resulted in the death of American soldiers?
I don't think that either Iran or these groups wanted to kill American soldiers because they knew that that would be a bridge too far and the U.S. would have to react very aggressively. I think the broad strategy here is to attack the United States, attack Israel, consolidate the strategic gains that they made on October 7th and continue to make sure that the guerrillas win and the conventional Israeli army loses, as you mentioned in your introduction. But I don't think that every decision is made in Tehran. And it only takes something big like the killing of the three American soldiers that might lead to essentially that kind of a command and control. I mean, there have been 160 attacks made on U.S. targets, more than that, and perhaps as the time we're speaking. And I don't think every one of these is managed out of Tehran. I think Iran has given the broad support that this is the time to put pressure on U.S. and Israel. But I don't think they manage them as tightly as we are assuming.
Mina, this is creates something of a quandary for many of the Gulf states. They have no love for Iran. They have no love for these militias that often stir up trouble for the Saudis. The Houthis in Yemen have been a sworn enemy. And yet, I was in the region 10 days ago, they really don't want a wider war, right? So which is dominating right now, the desire to punch Iran in a sense, or the desire to not let this spread into something wider?
I would say the primary priority at the moment is not to let it spread further. The Gulf requires stability, always wants to see a de-escalation. Absolutely, there are huge concerns about these militias. Let's not forget that the Houthis attacked both the UAE and Saudi Arabia before they were attacking ships in the Red Sea. There's a sense that a limit has to be put on these militias. Jordan, and the attack that the three American soldiers were killed in was on Jordan. That was the first time that you have these militias targeting Jordan so directly. And so there is a concern this is going to get out of control. But the key concern in the Gulf at the moment is getting a ceasefire in Gaza, which will take away some of the excuses that these groupings are using to escalate further. And the second, to see a serious American strategy on how to deal with these militias. Again, these militias have been getting stronger and stronger for at least the last 15 years. And part of it has been because of the U.S. turning a blind eye, seeing that they can live with them as long as their own troops are not targeted. And yet we see them escalating year on year.
Mina, Vali, stay with us. When we come back, we will get to precisely this question of what to do about the militias and what to do in Gaza when we come back.
This podcast is supported by NetSuite. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit from NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/GPS. netsuite.com/GPS.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back with Vali Nasser and Mina Al-Orebi. Vali, let me pick up on what Mina was saying just before the break, which was, that Washington has let these militias grow. Hezbollah began in the Lebanese war in the 80s, but Hamas, then the Houthis, then those militias in Iraq and in Syria, all of them backed and financed by Iran. What is the best strategy? David Sanger in the New York Times today has an analysis piece, which I thought was very interesting, where he says hitting Iran hard has not proved to deter them. He points out that the assassination of Soleimani, the Iranian commander, did not really deter Iran, as we can see now, but that sometimes negotiating with them has had some at least temporary effect on pausing Iranian activities. How do you think the U.S. should be handling this issue of getting these militias to cease and desist?
I think David is correct in the sense that when the United States killed Soleimani, even Iran reacted with the single largest missile attack that the U.S. forces have ever encountered. And it was very fortunate that at that point that did not lead to a much larger war. And then it's also true that before October 6th, the United States and Iran had somehow arrived at a modus vivendi that led the National Security Advisor to think that the Middle East was at its most peaceful moment over a decade. But we are where we are. And the dilemma that the United States faces is that the Gaza war has become a cause for the escalation in these attacks for reasons that Mina mentioned, that these groups see an advantage or an opportunity in pursuing a much more aggressive behavior, put pressure on Israel and the United States. So the U.S. faces a dilemma. It needs to end this war or arrive at a ceasefire, because the last time we had a ceasefire for 8 days was the only time that all the guns went silent in the Middle East. But if you have a ceasefire at this moment, in effect, Hamas, Iran, and Hezbollah has won in the way that Henry Kissinger explained it. On the other hand, if you do not have a ceasefire, the United States is running a serious risk of ending up in a direct confrontation with Houthis, Iran, or Shia militias in Iraq, or all three of them at the same time. So I think the United States has to make a choice. Does it want to sort of take the first step, at least get to a ceasefire, calm down the region, then think about a much longer, broader strategy of what are you going to do about the Houthis, the Shia militias, and Iran? Or is it going to pursue a policy of trying to intimidate them and run a huge risk of ending up in a war? And both sides can miscalculate in a moment like this.
Mina, what do you think that the Gulf Arabs, the United Arab Emirates, the Saudis, the Bahrainis would want? Because again, they have this dilemma, which is they don't like Iran, but the Iranians are now taking advantage of the Palestinian issue and the Gaza war, and are seen, I think, as much more of the champions of that cause. The Gulf Arabs are largely silent. There's been some condemnation, but it's the Houthis who are launching missiles. It's Hezbollah that is launching missiles, and they claim on behalf of the Palestinian cause.
Well, I mean, Hezbollah and the Houthis want that, and the militias in Iraq want that to be the narrative, that actually the way you support the Palestinians is by launching missiles here and there, rather than having a concerted effort to get the recognition of the Palestinian state, which is actually what the Arab League, what Saudi Arabia, what the UAE and others are working towards. So I think it's really important in the framing to think what success is and what we want. And ultimately, there has to be a Palestinian state that would end a lot of what we're seeing now. The United States, Fareed, you began the program by saying that the United States wants to get out of the Middle East. The reality is, the United States is in the Middle East and gets involved to prolong certain wars or conflicts without ending them or taking a final solution on them. So we'll give an example when it comes to Israel and Palestine. Without the American veto, there would have likely been a call from the UN for a ceasefire that would have been binding. And yet it's the United States that uses the veto. So it is involved. Likewise, when we look at the Houthis, one of the first measures that the Biden administration did was to remove the Houthis from the terrorist designation that they had for the attacks that they had done in the region, and therefore gave this impression that it's okay for them to continue. And the list goes on. The U.S. is involved enough. Ultimately, to weaken these militias, you need nation states that function. Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, their weakness has allowed for Iran to extend its power and its influence. One of the key things Iran has wanted to be able to create in the region is to have a land border and control running from Iran all the way to Hezbollah, so cutting through Iraq, cutting through Syria, and into Lebanon. And so has worked for years on this and continues to wield its influence. What we're seeing on the ground also in the last 2 days, you've seen these militia leaders appear in Baghdad to say we are still here. Qasem Musleh, whose liwa was, or the brigade that was targeted by the Americans in their strikes on Iraq most recently, was there in public being seen in hospitals to say, I can walk about with full impunity in Iraq. If you had a strong nation state that holds to account militia leaders, then we would be having a different conversation rather than waiting for airstrikes that really don't bring a solution on their own. It's hard work, but you need stronger states.
We will have to leave it at that. Mina, Vali, really thoughtful, insightful comments on an evolving situation. We hope we'll have you back. Next on GPS, I will talk to a longtime conservative who says the GOP's blockage of aid to Ukraine is a great betrayal. As the war in Ukraine rages on, American aid is drying up. That's because Republicans in Congress continue to block White House efforts to provide new funding, insisting that America must first secure its own borders. The Senate is expected to vote this week on a deal that ties aid for Ukraine and Israel to immigration reform. Joining me now is David Frum, staff writer at The Atlantic, who called the delay in aid the GOP's great betrayal. Welcome, David. Explain what you mean and why you see this as such a betrayal.
President Biden's request for aid was sent to Congress on October 20th. Last Sunday was the 100th day of a Republican blockade on the aid package, Israel, Ukraine, plus $14 billion to enforce the border. That came after the month of September, when Republicans refused to include aid to Ukraine, House Republicans, aid to Ukraine in the package to keep the government open. There is a blockade going on, and it's obviously not motivated by the things Republicans say. President Biden on the border has yielded to Republican demands in a way that is just unprecedented. He has accepted a series of measures to harden the border without asking in return for the things Democrats usually want: pathway to citizenship for young people brought to this country illegally at an early age, an increase in green cards. He hasn't asked for any of those things. He has said to the Republicans, I will give you what you say you want on the border if you give me what the country and the world needs on Ukraine. And they have said no. The answer is no to every question.
David, do you think that fundamentally there are a lot of Republicans who just don't want to support Ukraine? Is that part of what's going on here, a kind of new strain of isolationism?
Well, we can chart the numbers in vote after vote since 2022. And we can see is the number of hardcore anti-Ukraine Republicans is quite small. It's maybe a quarter, if even that, of the Republican caucus, so an eighth of the House of Representatives. And there are maybe just three or four hardcore anti-Ukraine Republicans in the Senate. This is about loyalty to Trump, and it's about Trump's connections. You know, and this takes us back to the biggest question about Donald Trump as president. I keep saying with Trump in Russia, there are many secrets, but there are no mysteries. It's been obvious that something is really wrong. And right now, his favorite broadcaster, Tucker Carlson, is literally in Moscow doing who knows what as we speak here, while the party that takes Trump's orders in the House and Senate is blockading aid to Ukraine.
You have been a long time hawk or hardliner, call it will you, on immigration. You've often argued for much tougher border enforcement and all that kind of thing. But you think in this case, with the Republican criticism of Biden that he could just do this by himself without Congress, is not valid. Explain why.
Well, this gets us to a crucial point, and a kind of technical point. In the 1990s and 2000s, when people crossed the border, they were coming knowingly and intentionally illegally. These were young men, typically in their early 20s, typically from Mexico or Central America, and they walked across the border and they tried to avoid contact with law enforcement and then slip into the job market in ways without coming into any contact with any kind of official. So enforcement was the answer for illegal immigration. That's not what's happening now. What's happening now is you have minors, people under 18, or family groups coming, and they are seeking contact with the law because they want to enter the asylum system where the law is on their side. Anyway, the law is on their side that they get to stay in the country pending a hearing, which can take years, decades. So back in the 1990s and 2000s, you could say, yes, enforce the rules against illegal immigration. But with asylum seekers, the rules are on the asylum seeker side. You have to change the rules. And we're talking here about international treaties. We're talking about statutes, but above all, about judicial precedents. If you want to change those, you need acts of Congress.
And are the Republicans proposing those kind of changes to asylum laws?
Senator Lankford has, and some of them are in the House bill H.R. 2, probably more draconian than even most Republicans would really want if they thought H.R. 2 was a real law. But the deal that is being worked on in the Senate would make important reforms. It would say things like you cannot, that if you want asylum, you have to prove that you personally, it's not just that the situation is lawless or the country's impoverished, but that you personally are being targeted for some reason you can't help or that you have a right to do, like your religion or your race. But people are coming to the United States and saying, back in where I'm from, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of crime, there's a lot of domestic abuse, and I've walked through 3, 4, 8, 10, 12 countries on my way to get to this one. And so the bills that are being negotiated in the Senate would say, no, those are not good enough reasons. And if you've crossed, if you were in danger in country one, and you've crossed countries 2, 3, 4, 5, and refused refuge in countries 2, 3, 4, 5, you can't pick and choose where you get your asylum.
Finally, and we only have 30 seconds, so a quick thought, David. Why have we had this eruption? I mean, I understand that people are gaming the system and using the asylum laws, but still, why millions and millions? What explained this explosion of, you know, traffic on the border?
Basically, the rise in global prosperity. It costs some thousands of dollars to make a move from a poorer country to a richer country, and the number of people who can afford that is on the rise. We're not seeing people on the move because the planet is miserable. We're seeing people on the move in search of opportunity on a planet where more and more people can afford to make the investment to give it a try. Don't blame them. You would do the same in their situation. I don't blame them at all. They're making rational moves. But in the numbers that we're getting, the rest of the world cannot cope with this number of people all at the same time.
David Frum, very smart stuff. And if people want to see the range of your writing, you have an amazing, excellent piece on Woodrow Wilson in The Atlantic right now. So maybe one of these days we'll have you back to talk about that. Thank you. Next on GPS, is China's economic miracle over? I will talk to Martin Wolf of the Financial Times.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Evergrande was once the second largest real estate developer in China. This week, a court ordered the bankrupt company to be liquidated. It is one more tale of China's economic woes. Last year, the country's GDP growth came in at a three-decade low, if you exclude the pandemic years. Has China hit bottom? Will the government be able to revive the world's second largest economy? Joining me is Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator at the Financial Times. Welcome, Martin. You are just the man to help us understand, because this is in many ways the biggest puzzle in the global economy. You know, is China headed for a decade of Japan-like stagnation, or is it going to be able to revive itself? So 20 years from now, most likely, what would historians say about China's growth trajectory. You know, what made it boom for 30 years and why has that boom come to an end?
Well, I think the boom, as you put it, has come to an end for fairly natural reasons. Growing at 10% a year, or anything close to it, for more than 40 years would be absolutely extraordinary. It was bound to slow. Many of the exceptional opportunities they had to catch up technologically, the enormous mass urbanization of the Chinese people, not finished, but it's much of it is done. The colossal investment boom that went with building capital of all kinds for the first time, that's all over. So what we are really betting on is what does the Chinese state prepared to do to promote a greater efficiency, greater dynamism in their economy. If they could do that, then I think they could still grow at 4%, maybe even more than 4% a year for the next 20 years. And that would still be double America's rate. So it would still be catching up, just never again. It'll never again be the sort of economy it was up till now.
So you put it very well, it seems to me, that there's a big debate taking place among China watchers. Is the government not doing more to reform the economy because there's a kind of policy paralysis? She is, you know, has put in a bunch of new people. The party has become more powerful than the government. Or is it that Xi Jinping doesn't want a more marketized, more reformed, more, consumer friendly economy, that he wants a state driven economy? You know, which do you think it is, looking at the data as you can tell?
My guess is it's a bit of both. It seems that she doesn't look like somebody for whom growth is an overwhelming priority, certainly if it reduces in any way or threatens in any way state control over the economy. But I think it's also true that the changes they would have to make at this stage, because the past models, the export-led growth model and high investment-led model, are over, they have to change a lot.
Do you think some of it is that she is at heart a kind of austerity nut or an austerity person? You know, he seems to not believe in the idea of sort of goosing the economy, helicoptering cash, as they used to call it. He often talks about how it's important for Chinese people to endure pain, even young people. He gave a speech saying, you guys have had it too easy. You need to suffer more. It builds character.
Yes, I think that seems to be an important part of his attitude to controlling the society. And he might also think, look, we've been, as you put it, goosing the economy at least since the financial crisis. And all we've got is these enormous headaches, a huge amount of debt. The debt ratio in China has tripled roughly since then. We can't go on doing that. It's unsustainable. And we've produced all these ridiculous, useless property, which nobody wanted. So I don't like that either. So I think he seems to have moral objections and he dislikes the waste, I think. But it doesn't mean that he's got an alternative. And I'm not at all convinced from the people I've talked to that the Chinese people are prepared to accept the low growth austere economy.
So you've often pointed out that there are only two components fundamentally to growth. One is the number of workers you have, and secondly, how productive they are. And you've been pointing out Chinese productivity has been declining. And Chinese fertility rates, the number of workers, are declining sharply. Are these such large overhangs that it's very difficult to imagine, fundamental revival of China, and that they are going down Japan's path?
I mean, the rate of growth of the labor force is a given. There's no way it's suddenly going to explode upwards. They can obviously employ some of the people and young people who are now unemployed. But the labor force is likely to shrink at something like a rate of 1% a year. They're not going to have mass immigration that will change that for China. So that's a given. So the question is, can they raise productivity? And the key point there is they've got the potential because they're still so poor. That's why they're not Japan. But to exploit the potential, they have to do quite a lot of big stuff that will shift the economy in a more dynamic direction again. And it's not clear, for the reason we've discussed, that she really wants to do that. And perhaps he's prepared to sit it out and accept 3% growth, at the most 4, and that's okay.
Martin Wolf, thank you for helping us understand this very complicated subject. Next on GPS, Argentina's newly minted leader is called the madman by his own supporters. And some of his ideas are really out there. But could they possibly work? We'll be back with that in a moment. More than 2 months ago, Argentina stunned the world when it elected a new president, Javier Milei, who calls himself an anarcho-capitalist libertarian. Milei wants to abolish the country's central bank, and one of his favorite campaign props was a chainsaw, signaling his goal of slashing up the state. It may not be terribly surprising that he's also a big admirer of Donald Trump. So can Milei actually fix Argentina's economy, or will he bring it further into ruin? With me now is Shannon O'Neill. She's a senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the book, The Globalization Myth, Why Regions Matter. Shannon, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the interesting thing about Milei is he's different from, you know, there are some people who say, oh, he's sort of like Bolsonaro, who was this kind of right-wing populist. And then there are people who say, well, he's a bit like AMLO, the left-wing populist. But he's different. Explain who this guy is.
Well, what he has in common is he's anti-establishment, but he's anti-Argentine establishment, which is different than almost any other countries. So he's coming in and he's appealing to an audience and to voters, especially young voters who are tired of high, if not hyperinflation, of recession, of financial booms and busts, of the difficulties of life in day-to-day in Argentina. And so he's come in.
Which have been run by a kind of populist, Peronist establishment for decades.
For decades, right? They've either been in office or have been waiting to come into office, controlling the unions, controlling many of the public sector workers, controlling lots of the apparatus, the governors and the like. And so Milei came in saying, a pox on all of your houses. I want to get rid of all the establishment politicians. I'm an economist who got into this just because I went on TV talk shows and was entertaining, hence the chainsaw. But he brings in a privatization message, a dollarization message, a cutting down of the state, and a balancing of the budget, which is not what the previous, especially the Peronist Party, had ever done. So that's what appeals to people, something different because the economy isn't working.
So in a way, he's kind of like a throwback to a Margaret Thatcher or somebody like that.
He is. In fact, he idolizes Margaret Thatcher, which, you know, Argentina and Britain have had their differences in the past over the Falklands or what the Argentines call the Malvinas. But yes, he's very much an accolade of Margaret Thatcher, of others, what he would say, libertarians around the world. And he really is focused on the economy. He is socially conservative on gender issues, on gun issues, on crime and the like. But he's really focused on economics. That is his big message and what he started to do.
And fair to say that the Peronists, who I describe as sort of broadly left-wing populists, have run the Argentine economy into the ground over the decades.
They have. They will come in and they'll spend lots of money. They'll hire lots of people to work for the government. They'll give lots of monies to unions or to other groups. They're a leftist organization, but they really are a patronage organization, right? They have lots of clients here. But it's been unsustainable, the way they spend money for a country that isn't producing enough of money or enough taxes or revenues to support it. So each time they get in trouble and they end up defaulting on debt, local debt, international debt. And so Milei is coming in saying, we're going to stop that whole cycle that repeats itself again and again with the Peronists.
And places like Davos, I think they warmed to him partly because he's got the crazy rhetoric at times, but he's also got some very smart advisors.
He does have smart advisors, and he went from the campaign to governing and brought in more mainstream economists. I think he speaks to the Davos crowd, to the international financial community, because he's talking about balancing budgets and privatizing and the kinds of market-friendly elements there. He also has the backing of the IMF. The IMF made the biggest bet it's made in its history with Argentina back a couple of presidents ago, lent them almost $50 billion, and now they need to be repaid. And I think the IMF is embracing him because they think he is a president who might actually repay them.
And what about the crazy hair and the, is that all part of a kind of anti-establishment shtick? Was he always like this?
I think he's always been a little bit of an idiosyncratic person. It makes good TV. And so obviously part of his charm or his attraction is that he has crazy hair. He's doesn't have a family, but he does have clone dogs. That's a big part of his selling point. But right now it seems, one, he has moved from the more fringe to a much more serious set of policies and approach and those people around him. And, you know, I think Argentines, at least right now, are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. They're willing to accept shock therapy and austerity with the hope that a year from now, things will be better for them.
Ironically, it all hinges on the weather, doesn't it?
It all hinges on the weather because Argentina's biggest source of dollars, its biggest source of income in the world, is agricultural products, particularly soy. So if it rains, then Argentina and Milei will probably have a good chance. If it doesn't, and there's a drought like there was last year, then I'm not sure his government will make it. And these promised policies that everyone at Davos and the world is looking at will actually come through.
Look at soybeans. Sounds like something out of Trading Places. Shannon O'Neill, pleasure to have you on.
Great to be here.
Before we go, I want to let you know that you can now watch my documentaries on Max. There are 15 of them up on the streaming service on everything from polarization in America to the rise of Xi Jinping to the promise and peril of artificial intelligence. It's work I'm very proud of, and I hope you will take a look. And thanks to all of you for being part of my program this week. I will see you next week.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.